Smith sent word to Chesty Puller to mobilize any force Puller could spare and send them northward with all speed. Among the troops in Puller's command was a British unit, the 41st Independent Commandos of the British Royal Marines, led by Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Drysdale. Drysdale was an experienced combat veteran of the Burma campaign in World War II, who had sought out and was delighted to receive assignment to serve alongside Chesty Puller. By morning, Colonel Drysdale's assignment would change. Though Puller had barely 2,000 men to defend Koto Ri, Drysdale would assume command of a task force of nearly half of Puller's forces. Accompanied by tanks and a large number of supply trucks, Drysdale would push northward, with no real idea what kind of obstacles the Chinese would put in their way. Smith understood the chances Drysdale would take. Every report reaching Hagaru Ri from the radio transmitters in Koto Ri and Chin Hung to the haphazard messages passed along from chopper and fighter pilots told the same story. The Chinese were in strength, surrounding every position the Marines now occupied. With nightfall again settling over the Chosin Reservoir, every outpost, every headquarters, every frontline platoon commander was keeping his men on the alert, waiting for the inevitable attack. Chapter 25. Riley. Fox Hill, November 28, 1950, 6 p.m. The planes had come again, but not the Blue Corsairs. This time there had been 8 P-51 Mustangs, the beloved fighter that had once turned the tide against the German Messerschmitts in World War II. The appearance of the Mustangs was a surprise, and very quickly the air spotter passed the word that they were flown by Australians. Like the Marines who flew the Corsairs, the Australians were fearless, skimming the hilltops, dipping low into the valleys, pouring a devastating mix of machine gun, rocket, and cannon fire on the Chinese positions. As the Mustangs turned away, the Marines cheered them, new respect for an old ally. The Corsairs had returned as well, but they did not come to help the men on Fox Hill. To the dismay of Captain Barber's Marines, the Corsairs continued northward, word passing again from the air spotter that the planes were destined for U Dam Ni. Barber's weakening radio had made brief contact with Litzenberg's headquarters, and the news both ways was bad. Litzenberg had hoped to bring Fox Company northward, precious strength adding to the forces fending off increasing pressure from the Chinese. But Barber's people had nowhere to go. Throughout the morning, scouting parties had probed the ground in all directions, seeking alternative routes southward that might allow Fox Company to return to Hagaru Ri. But the Chinese were on every hill, in every valley, in every direction. With the road to Hagaru Ri blocked completely, and with no help coming from Litzenberg, Barber knew that Fox Company could very well be wiped out. It was nearly dark, and already stars were appearing, a clear sign that tonight would be as cold as any they had endured. With the shift in the positions of the perimeter, new foxholes were dug, more slit trenches, the men laboring through the cold, knowing the warmth of their sweat was temporary, that once again the officers would order foot inspections, the men changing their socks as quickly as the work was completed. This time there were no complaints. As they struggled to chop into rock and frozen dirt, Riley and every man around him were aware that Barber's orders to dig the holes, so vigorously cursed the night before, had saved many of their lives. Riley wiped the wetness from his skin with his spare shirt, fumbled with the buttons, his fingers already turning numb. He watched Killian blowing on his fingers, did the same, a brief remedy, allowing him to fasten a single button. "Christ, Sean, this is nuts!" Killian didn't answer, buried himself in his coat, sat, curling up in a ball, the sleeping bag pulled over his legs. Riley worked the buttons, the shirt finally fastened up completely, and he grabbed his coat, wrapped himself tightly, the hood pulled down hard over his head. He ducked low, shivered, his arms wrapped around him, waiting for the relief, his breathing inside his coat aimed down over his chest, the only warmth there was. He waited, wouldn't move again just yet, the cold soaking his brain, every part of him, but easing now, his breathing slower, some feeling again in his limbs. He slid his feet outward, the next task, pulled at the boots, his socks soaked with sweat. He grunted, slid them off his stinging feet, tossed the socks aside, the fresh pair going on quickly, his gloved hands massaging his toes. The boots went back on, the cold in the bottom harsh, still wet, and he cursed, said, "What jackass decided these were the right boots?" Killian didn't look up, the hood low over his face, said, "A jackass who never had to wear the damn things. They say the Corps buys stuff from the lowest bidder. Just once I'd pay extra to get whatever was made by the most expensive guy. Just once. Boots, sea rations, doesn't matter." Riley curled his legs beneath him, sat gingerly, knew better than to put his legs to sleep. "I bet the rifles are the best ones. They make sure of that."
"Like hell they do. I heard the Sarge say he had to junk his carbine. He's got a Thompson, the one you grabbed off that Shambo."
Riley knew Welch was a few yards away, another of the fresh holes dug in virtually a straight line across the crest of the hill.
"Maybe. That's fine as long as he's got ammo."
Killian didn't answer, sat quietly, a dark lump at one end of the narrow hole. The ammo drop had come that afternoon, a single cargo plane swooping in low, pallets of boxes dumped out with barely enough altitude for the parachutes to break their fall. But the ammo had been received with eagerness and cheers, the grenades and mortar shells replenishing supplies that had been nearly exhausted. The rifle ammo had come as well, Captain Barber ordering it to be distributed quickly, every man stuffing his coat with as much as the supply officers allowed. Later in the day, a single helicopter had arrived, just long enough to drop a supply of fresh batteries for the captain's radio. For the wounded, the helicopter offered a brief bit of hope of transport off the hill. But the snipers had targeted the chopper immediately, the pilot forced to escape with a crippled engine. He felt the familiar rumble of hunger. A new thought. "Hey, Sean, I heard the supply drop didn't have any rations at all. Just ammo."
"You surprised? If we can't fight off the Shambos, we won't be needing much for dinner. That's the kind of thinking officers get paid for."
Riley slid his backpack closer, felt inside. "I got a Tootsie Roll left. A can of something. Fruit, maybe. I'll split it with you."
"No, I still got this turkey leg. Figured I'd suck on it a while."
Riley laughed to himself, but he knew Killian was serious. Thought, he's carried that stupid thing in his pack for nearly a week. "Good luck. Your spit won't be warm enough to thaw it out. It might stick to your tongue." Two men were crawling along the hill behind the line, and Riley saw a third man coming up with them, Lieutenant Goolsby. The two men dragged a cloth bag between them, slid closer to a foxhole a few yards away, and Goolsby said, "One per hole. It's sterno. You only got a half hour, so use it. Thaw out something to eat. Thaw out your fingers, too. But the captain says to kill the fire at 18:30. The two men tossed a can into each hole, one rolling into Riley's. He grabbed it, as cold as anything around him, was surprised to see Killian produce a lighter, a small flicker of flame. Riley pulled his knife, popped open the lid, held it out, and Killian lit the contents, the pink goo sparking to life. He set the can in the bottom of the hole, one hand close to the meager flame. Killian said,
"A half hour. Hell, you couldn't eat a thimbleful of coffee that quick.
Riley gave out a low laugh. Put your turkey leg over it. Always did enjoy an outdoor barbecue. Killian sniffed, pulled one boot off, held one stockinged foot over the flame. Riley kept his hands close to the round can, absorbing the warmth. He looked at Killian's foot, said, How's the toes? You ain't walking too good. The Sarge noticed that. He's watching you. Killian withdrew the foot, yanked the boot on, his face hidden.
Foot's fine. The Sarge can worry about you.
McCarthy was there now, keeping low, and he knelt close behind the row of foxholes, said,
Listen up. Just got word from the captain. No matter what happens tonight, in the next hour or two, nobody leaves these holes. The captain's radio worked just long enough to make contact with the artillery battery in Hagaru Re. A flock of 105s supposed to be supporting us. They're going to range the hills around us in a few minutes. The draws, too.
He paused.
They got orders that if we're overrun, they're to turn this hill to mush. Anybody gets up and wanders around, they might turn you to mush, too. If we're going to end up in hell, at least we'll take a pile of chinks with us. Now keep low. They start dropping shells out here. It's just a show for now. We've got enough casualties without losing anybody to friendly fire. Okay, I need every one of you to test your weapons. Fire off a round. Now!
McCarthy was close behind Welch's hole, his voice reaching them all. Riley obeyed, raised the M1, fired, checked the breech, the next round moving into place. Killian did the same, and to one side Riley heard familiar cursing. Welch.
Forget the damn carbine. It won't eject worth a damn. I got a single shot and have to screw with the bolt for 5 minutes to fire the next one. I'll stick with the Thompson.
Down the line, other rifles fired. The telltale burst from a BAR. More curses. McCarthy crawled along the hard ground behind the line, said,
Find a rag, anything that will work. Get as much lube cleaned out of the action as you can, no matter what weapon you're using. Work the bolt every few minutes. Nelson, how's the 30?
The burst of fire came down to the right.
Not bad, sir.
Fire off another burst every hour, at least. Those bastards will hit us again sure as hell, and for whatever reason, their weapons aren't all gummed up like we are. We pulled a bottle of some kind of oil off one of the chinks. Captain says it's whale oil. I don't know. But their weapons are doing just fine. Grab one if you get the chance, and pay attention to your grenades. Don't just pull the pins. Pull the hammer up before you throw it. They're mostly frozen together, and all you'll be doing is smacking them with a baseball. Fire around every hour. You got that?
McCarthy moved away toward the far end of the line. More orders. More single shots ringing out to the left side of the hill. Riley glanced that way, thought, Second platoon. Pretty close to us. Killian rose up, watching him, his hands over the small flame.
Ain't very many of us.
Riley had made a count in his head, said, Half of us got hit, I think. A couple dozen still up here. He looked at the arsenal spread out along the edge of their hole, the Russian rifles Killian had salvaged. Another M1 from one of the Marines, no longer using it. Everybody's got more weapons than they know what to do with. We'll be okay.
I know exactly what to do with them.
Riley didn't answer. Looked out past the hole, toward Welch, thought. He's got his own arsenal, and Morelli's with him now. Good. He thought of Welch's words earlier, how the new men had shot up all their ammo. Guess I did, too, back then. They give you a rifle, they expect you to use it. The enemy runs up your ass, he expects it, too. As long as the supply people can drop those crates out here, we'll put up a fight. He wanted to shout over to Welch, thought better of it. He knows I'm here, and he'll take care of the kid. He turned his gaze to the hillside, darker now, the snow a thin blanket, deeper drifts blown against the scattered rocks. To one side, Lieutenant McCarthy had positioned Freddie Nelson's crew, manning a light machine gun, and Riley looked that way, could see the gun surrounded by a low rock pile, and more, the stacked bodies of the enemy. We should have done that, he thought. There's enough dead Chinese to go around. But this hole is deep. Plenty of cover. They come. We'll be ready, I guess. He stared again down the wide hill across the saddle, the distant hill hidden in darkness. They will come. Like us. They got no place else to be. There was an odd smell, and he searched, realized it was close, and he looked down. Killian with his hands out over the soft blue flame, holding the turkey leg. Fox Hill, November 28, 1950, 10 p.m. The artillery had found their range, Riley watching in amazement as the spotters directed the fire from the big guns so many miles away. All around Fox Hill, the incoming fire had peppered the high ground in nearly every direction, a reminder to the enemy that even in the darkness, they were vulnerable. The mortars had the range as well. The 60 and 81 millimeter tubes spread all around the hill, each squad choosing a likely direction to aim their fire. The mortars launched illuminated shells as well as the usual high explosive, an enormous benefit for the men in the foxholes, offering a glimpse of just where the enemy assault might be forming. Riley had found an hour's sleep, had the watch now, still embraced by the sleeping bag up to his waist. He could hear Killian snoring, an odd mix of spits and hisses and grumbles, what might have been the easiest way to make enemies in a barracks. But the sounds kept Riley entertained, helped to focus his mind, keep his thoughts away from the film of icy frost he couldn't avoid around his eyes. The shivering came often, the heavy coat not quite adequate, and as he scanned the darkness, he tried to guess the temperature. He was beginning to feel the difference, just how much pain it caused to breathe, how far down his throat the air would threaten to freeze him. With each stiff breeze that slapped his face, tears would come, turning to ice in a minute or less, gluing his eyes shut. It happened now, and he wiped gently, blew into his cupped hands, directed the warmer air upward over his eyes. 10 below zero meant his tears would freeze in a full minute. 20 below, half that time. Tonight there were short seconds between the clear glimpses of darkness and the agony of blindness, his fingers wiping at the raw skin around his eyes yet again. He shifted his feet in the bag, the cold finding him even down low. God, he thought, it's 25 below, 50 below. Hell, what difference does it make? The damn Chinese don't seem to care. He didn't know that, of course, had wondered with the others just how miserable they could be. Their shoes had been a shock, the thin canvas over rubber soles, offering no protection at all. They got to keep moving, he thought. I guess that's what they're doing now, marching up and down the hills out there, keeping warm as best they can. He was curious about the quilted uniforms, just how much protection they provided, but few of the Marines had any notion of trying them on. The smell, even in the cold, could be nauseating, the thick stench of rotten garlic. There's bugs, too, he thought. Maybe like Okinawa, the damn fleas infesting every piece of cloth you found. Well, maybe not. How cold does it have to be to kill fleas? But we ain't taking any baths up here, and we stink just as bad as any of them, even without the garlic. Beside him, Killian grumbled, a loud snort, and now to one side, Welch said, Jesus, he's waking up the whole mountain. The damn chinks can zero in on us just by listening to him. Let him sleep, Sarge. Welch didn't respond, and Riley could hear more of the low talk around him, the men filling the darkness with tall tales, gripes, any kind of distraction from the cold. There was a strange whine coming from the left of the saddle, lower on the far hill. More whines came now, and Riley stared that way, the talk around him quieting. Now a voice, loud, uneven, broken by the static from a radio transmitter. "Hello, Marines! You have few numbers, and we are very many. We are surrounding you. You will die very soon. You must all surrender. It is the wise thing. Do not be foolish." The crackling and hissing stopped, and the men began to respond, vulgar shouts across the hillside. Riley heard Killian stirring, the muffled question,
"What the hell?"
"Go back to sleep. The enemy's got somebody who knows English. He keeps that up after daylight. Somebody'll take him out."
"Marines, do you wish to die? You must surrender now. Save yourselves. Do not die for the generals in their comfortable homes. They have Korean girls to favor them. You have only death."
There was a burst from a machine gun down that way, a futile gesture, streaks of red tracers pouring down into the draw. Welch rose up, and Riley heard the familiar cursing. Then McCarthy was there. Shouted out,
"Save your damn ammo! That's what he wants!"
"Marines, think of your wives back home, how they would enjoy you with them, not out here where you will only die."
The crackling gave way to the harsh whine again, more feedback, and then the first notes of music. The responses came again, more threats and curses from the men along the hilltop, the music now louder still. Riley stared through the darkness, amazed at the effort by the Chinese, the utter ridiculousness of their propaganda. The music continued, clearer now, his own mind opening up, the music finding its way inside. Memories he didn't want. He pushed hard at that, joined in the shouting. There were more rifles firing now, a pair of machine guns. It was a useless exercise against one Chinese officer's seductive plan. Just enough awareness of their culture, their homesickness, their emotions. The outrage was complete. Anger at the enemy's simple-minded approach. The Marines absorbing the insult that someone out there thought a piece of music would tempt them to walk off their hill. But the music continued. And gradually the exhausted Marines realized there was nothing they could do to stop it. And so, with eyes still focused on the darkness, the men began to listen, some of them to enjoy. It was, after all, Bing Crosby, and it was White Christmas. Fox Hill, November 29th, 2 a.m. The mortars came first, no warning at all, a sudden rain of explosives all along the crest of the hill. Riley dropped low, a spray of dirt and shattered rock coming down. Voices called out, McCarthy, Welch, the unnecessary warning. "Make ready, they'll be coming." Riley waited for a pause in the incoming shells, peered up over the edge of the hole, heard Welch.
"When the hell did they bring mortars up here?"
The words flowed through Riley's brain. If there's more weapons, it means there's more troops. Killian seemed to read his thoughts, said,
"I bet they sent reinforcements. We kicked their asses last night."
Riley put one hand up on the hood of his parka, shifted it, clearing his line of sight. He peered down the hill.
"They already forgot about last night. Watch that damn saddle. Both sides of it."
"Thanks, General. I've done this before, you know."
Riley felt the hard chill all through him, his nervousness adding to the raw cold.
"I know. Sorry."
"And there they come," Look, Killian called out now. Hey, Sarge, on the saddle.
I see him.
There was a burst of fire from the machine gun to the right, and now scattered firing all along the saddle itself. The mortars began now, pumping their shells over the heads of the Marines, dropping them all along the enemy's position. Riley stared, knew from the sound it was the 60 millimeters, knew that the gunners had already marked their range. The Chinese came in thin lines, advancing at a slow trot, white uniforms not quite disguised by the uneven snow. But the flashes from the mortar fire lit up the entire scene, enemy soldiers falling in clusters, some tossed aside by the close impact of the shells. The machine guns were rattling all along the hill now, the other guns joining in, down to the left. Riley pulled himself down into the hole, checked the M1, one hand reaching up, feeling for the rows of grenades. He put a hand down on the 45 at his waist, loosened it, took a long breath, then another, ignored the cold that sliced into his lungs. He waited for a long moment, staring into darkness, felt suddenly like crying. It was so familiar, a new surge of terror boiling up inside him, and he fought it, angry at himself, more furious at the enemy. There were grenade blasts now, very close, the first wave of enemy troops doing their job. But the Marines had prepared for that, tossing their own grenades, and now Riley could hear the voices through the sharp sounds, the enemy, wounded men screaming, torn apart. Behind them, more of the mortar rounds came down, streaks of light overhead, bursts of fire all down the hill. He took a long, deep, icy breath, blinked hard, clearing his vision, and the silent voice came now, inside his head, pushing away the fear. He kicked the sleeping bag from his feet, rose up, felt himself shouting. No words, just noise, raw and vicious. The flashes of light were everywhere, and he saw the targets, men tossing grenades, shot down. Men on their knees, some with rifles, and behind them more lines of men moving up the hillside through fire and smoke, past the screams of their own. The noise was deafening. The enemy machine guns throwing their green tracers across the ridge, the chatter adding to the chorus of rifle fire and grenade blasts. The fighting swirled around him, some of the enemy finding their way past the line, close-range fire from Chinese burp guns, the answering chatter of the BARs. Riley kept up his own fire, targets close in front of him, still outlined by the flashes of fire from the mortars. With each advance, the Chinese seemed to grow in number, more of them surging past the Marines, collapsing in a storm of fire from men behind the ridge. In front of Riley, it was more of the same scene. Rows of men shot down, blown aside, the gaps in the enemy's advance filled by more men coming up from behind. All across the line, the orders were shouted out, meaningless words, Riley's terror combining with the raw excitement, adding to the wonder of all that was happening around him. There was no time for thought, for checking the flanks. Throughout the assault, his brain focused on one place, the hillside below him, the relentless charge by an enemy who seemed infinite and unstoppable. Several times, more than he could count, the Chinese who were able had backed away, reforming, reloading, Riley using the brief pauses to check his own ammo, the clips in his pocket, only a few, the grenades on the ground in front of him, down to a pair. As the enemy pulled back, the mortars slowed, darkness returning, and he stared out with furious energy, his hands shaking, spinning cold inside his chest. He steadied his hand by his grip on the rifle, blinked rapidly, keeping his eyes clear. Beside him, Killian seemed to be searching for something, his voice adding to the shouts along the ridge.
Damn it all. I got nothing left. We gotta fix bayonets.
Riley forced his eyes off the ridge, looked at him, Killian down low, ripping through his backpack. Riley shouted, louder than he intended.
What is it? You out of ammo?
Killian ignored him, seemed obsessed with finding something, and Riley could see his rifle leaning up against the side of the hole, the bayonet already attached.
Get up! Your bayonet's fixed. What the hell's the matter with you?
I can't find it. It's gotta be here. They're coming.
Riley heard too much terror in Killian's voice, and he put a hand out, touched his shoulder.
Sean, look at your rifle. The bayonet's there.
Killian looked at him now. Seemed to calm.
They're coming again. I know it. They're hard to see.
Riley kept his hand on Killian's shoulder.
Yeah, I guess. You need ammo?
Killian kept low, pulled the rifle in tight to his chest.
I think so. I don't know. They coming again?
Riley glanced out past the hole. Men on the move, wounded being pulled back, a scramble from the ammo carriers.
Here! Ammo here!
One man stumbled closer, a heavy bag in his hand.
I got grenades. That's it. Ain't many. Give 'em here. Go get more. We need ammo.
The man dropped the bag, moved away without speaking, and Riley pulled the bag into the hole. Not heavy enough. Felt through the burlap.
Half a dozen. That's it. Damn!
Killian didn't move. Sat against the side of the hole, staring at him. Riley laid the grenades out along the lip of the hole. Said,
"You shoot up all the ammo for those Russian things?"
Killian didn't answer. Stood up now, the rifle down beside him.
"Sean, what the hell you doing? Get your ass down!"
Welch was there now, crawling low.
"What's going on? You need ammo?"
Riley said, "Yeah. I got 4 clips, 6 grenades, not sure about him." Welch rose up on his knees, pulled at Killian.
"What the hell's wrong with you?"
Killian looked at Welch, put one hand up on the side of his head.
"You son of a bitch, you hit me with a snowball."
Riley felt a sickening cold flowing all through him. Saw Welch reach out, put a hand inside the hood of Killian's coat.
"Oh, Christ! Corman!"
Riley felt paralyzed, and Welch looked at him, his hand extended.
"He's hit! Side of his neck!"
Riley absorbed the words, stared hard. Nothing to see in the dark. Killian still stood, seemed dazed, and Welch called again,
"Corman!"
A man ran forward, down on his knees beside Welch, the voice of McCarthy.
"Who's hit?"
"Irish. Wet blood."
McCarthy added to the chorus.
"Corman!"
Riley felt a new kind of panic. Stared at Killian, still standing, staring off. And now another man was there. A mumbling voice.
"Here. Who's hit?"
McCarthy motioned toward Killian.
"His neck."
The corman slipped into the hole, Riley climbing out, making room. He watched the corman pull something from his mouth, the man pulling Killian down gently, Killian settling into the bottom of the hole. The corman huddled low, said,
"I got him, sir. Doesn't feel too bad. I'll give him morphine and we'll get somebody out here to haul him down to the aid station."
McCarthy said,
"Good. We got plenty of men down. They hit us pretty hard. Sergeant, you know how to handle a 30?
Welch answered,
"Yes, sir. Been a while."
"You'll figure it out. Nelson's hit, down below. His crew's busted up by grenades. Get over there. Man that gun."
McCarthy looked at Riley now.
"Go with him. You're the crew. Your buddy's gonna be fine."
There was no discussion to be had. The lieutenant's orders clear. Welch was up quickly, the Thompson in his hands, and he said to Riley,
"Time to move."
Riley grabbed the rifle, the grenades stuffed into his pocket, He followed Welch, stumbled on the rocky ground, moved past scattered bodies, men in their holes, gathering up ammo, doing what he had done. Welch led him down into a cluster of rocks, one taller, one half of a wall. He saw the machine gun now, bodies scattered around, most of them Chinese, but not all. He moved toward one of the fallen Marines, knelt, stared, helpless. No idea what to do.
Get your ass over here. There's ammo in those cans.
They might need help.
They don't. Worry about them later. We got bigger problems.
Riley saw now the wide hillside below, movement in the snow, the moonlight catching the rows of men moving out into the open.
Jesus, they're coming again.
Welch wrestled with the machine gun, said,
Yeah, they're coming. Feed me the belts from this side.
Riley went to work now, felt the heft of the ammo boxes. Two full, one partial.
Looks like plenty.
Welch slapped the gun, settled low behind it, aimed, swiveled.
Ain't no such thing, Pete.
The mortars began again, a steady rhythm impacting all down the hill, out on the saddle, the Chinese responding with mortars of their own. The machine guns began their duel as well, the Marines keeping their focus on the enemy troops moving up the hill again. Lines of men in white, shot down. More, shot down again. Welch fired the machine gun, short bursts, seeking targets. The old training. Riley kept close by, feeding him the ammo, and within short minutes, the first box was empty. The barrel of the gun glowed red, and Welch aimed, stared silently. The Chinese were backing away again, disappearing into the darkness. But to both sides, the firing continued. Riley sat on the frozen ground, the rocks to one side offering perfect cover that way. But down the hill, the only cover came from the stacked bodies, pulled into place by Freddie Nelson. Riley hadn't checked the bodies nearby, had no idea if Nelson was one of the dead Marines or if they were part of Nelson's crew. You don't need to know, he thought.
How much we got left?
Riley pulled on the one remaining box, put one hand on the belts inside.
Not much. Go get more, while we got time.
Riley stared at him, said, Where?
How the hell do I know? Down the hill, back there. There's got to be supply idiots down there somewhere.
Riley looked back beyond the ridge, men in motion, corpsmen, litter bearers, others Riley couldn't see clearly.
Okay. You got ammo for that Thompson? Why? You planning on getting lost?
Nope,
but... Yeah, I got 5 magazines. Leave me your grenades and your M1.
Riley handed Welch his rifle, then emptied his pockets. Welch gathering up the grenades, laying them out beside the machine gun. Riley started to move, hesitated, said,
Not sure about this, Hemp. Hate leaving you alone. I'm not alone, you moron. I got the whole damn Marine Corps up here. Just find me some damn ammo.
Riley moved away toward the ridgeline, visible in the moonlight. He saw litter bearers, and he followed them, called out,
You ammo carriers?
No one responded, and Riley felt suddenly helpless, moved closer to another pair of litter bearers. He saw the man between them, wrapped in his coat, faceless, and Riley said,
Ammo dump?
The men kept moving, but one said, Yeah, follow me. There's crates down below by the CP. Riley stayed close to them, saw men moving in all directions, a spray of green tracers ripping above him. He ducked, instinct, the litter bearers moving away. There was rifle fire to the east, more down along the main road. He felt for his rifle, another instinct. Nothing there, realized he had left it with Welch. He kept moving, downhill now, saw the tents, a crush of activity, men laid out in rows, cries and shouts, others kneeling beside them, frantic activity.
You! Over here!
Riley realized the man was calling him, and he moved that way, the man pointing to one end of a stretcher.
Kneel down. Grab his feet. He tries to move, hold him tight.
He obeyed, put his hands on the wounded man's boots, a tight grip. The corpsman was doing his work, slipped something from his mouth. Riley watching him intently, the corpsman pulling back the man's shirt at the waist.
Only way to keep the morphine from freezing, hold it in your mouth. Just hope the damn syringe doesn't crack, or I'll be in Wonderland.
Riley realized the corpsman was talking through a mouthful, the man pulling another syringe from his mouth.
Plasma's worthless, freezes solid, and there's not a damn thing we can do about it. Even if it was thawed out, it's too cold. You'd kill a man pumping that into his veins. They didn't teach this stuff in med school.
You a corpsman?
Riley said, no, came down here to find ammo. Damn shame, I'm a doctor. I could use a dozen more corpsmen here.
He continued to work, then said, only good thing about this cold, the wounds freeze up. Man not as likely to bleed to death.
Well, two good things. The dead don't smell.
The doctor held a thick bandage on the man's groin, and Riley felt more helpless now. Kept his grip on the boots. Nothing to do but wait.
You need me still, sir?
The doctor stood, stretched his back.
No, go on. The captain'll be okay, I think. Right, sir?
The wounded man responded with a mumble, and Riley stood straight. Recognized the wounded man now. The face lit by a small lantern hanging on the nearby tent. It was Captain Barber. Fox Hill, November 29th, 3 a.m. The ammo cans weighed more the farther he climbed. Around him, the litter-bearers and so many others were scrambling past, cries for corpsmen in every direction. He focused on the rocks along the crest, the only landmark he could see, but the fiery blasts added to the blindness from the freezing wetness blanketing his eyes. He stopped, gasping for breath, the cold knifing into his lungs, and he bent low, the hood over his face, tried to find any strength at all. He stood again, the ammo cans in each hand, pushed forward, climbing, tried to ignore the aching in his shoulders. He crested the hill now, flashes of fire in every direction, the impact of the mortars still illuminating the saddle. But it was far out to the left, and he felt that familiar burst of panic, searched for the telltale rocks, strained to hear what might be Welch's machine gun. A flurry of fire whistled past him, and he ducked low, moved down the hill in a clumsy scamper. He stopped, crouched low, looked again for the saddle. Nothing there. Blind darkness. More flashes of fire cutting above him. The blast erupted behind him, shoving him over, tumbling him down the hill, his face smacking hard on the frozen ground. He lay for a long moment, a fog in his brain. Tried to see. Rolled over on his back, the sky above him streaked with fire. He kept still. Tested his legs. Flexed his feet. Pulled one hand into his coat, probing the soft places. No blood. Thank God. The ringing in his ears wiped away most of the noise around him, and he waited for another minute, then sat up slowly, still testing his bones. He slid the hood of his coat away, realized his helmet was gone, and pulled the hood forward again, the only protection he had. One hand went to his belt. The 45 there.
Yes.
And he squeezed his fingers around the butt, felt for the spare magazines beside it. There was no movement around him at all, his ears letting in a bit more sound, most of the firing farther away. He rose to his knees. Another test. Pain in his knees from the fall, but not crippling. The fog began to clear, and he could smell the shell that had come so close, the putrid stink of the spent powder.
Smells like one of ours, he thought. Okay, don't try to think. You don't know what theirs smells like, either.
He searched the ground for the ammo boxes. Nothing. Rocks and snow. He climbed higher, anxious searching. A sharp blast above him, along the crest, mortar shells, then another heavier blast down the hill, artillery. The lieutenant's word rolled through his brain. Mush. Okay, time to go. You get hit by a 105, nobody'll ever find you. He scanned the ground once more. No sign of the ammo, and he thought of Welch, furious, waiting with an empty machine gun. Okay, Hamp, take it easy. I'll find you. Eventually. I gotta find me first. Figure out where the hell I am. He started to move. Saw a movement close in front of him. Froze. A half dozen men slipping silently up toward the crest of the hill. The white uniforms stood out in the faint moonlight. The men moving slowly, careful steps. He felt a burst of ice in his chest, kept still, the men stepping past no more than a few yards away, seemingly wandering, no urgency, as though they were lost. There was talk now, Chinese. One man pointing, the others following his lead. They stopped, gathered up, seemed to scan the area, searching for something. One man dropping low, picking up a weapon. He held it at his waist, fired a single shot. A flash in the dark, the sound of an M1. More talk. Another man coming up the hill, joining them. Riley felt a screaming pain in his knees, kept completely still, his eyes crusting over, his breathing slicing into his throat and lungs, the cold returning, invading his clothing. His heart pounded, and he kept his eyes on them, eased one hand in toward the 45, agonizingly slow, a silent shout in his head, "Go on, get out of here." But the Chinese soldiers seemed content to stay put. Another pair coming up the hill, gathering with the others, examining the rifle. More talk. He slid his hand to the bottom of his coat, closer to the 45, and now there was a bright flash, then another. Grenades. He dropped flat, heard a burst of machine gun above him. He kept still, eased his head upward, strained to see, saw the muzzle blasts from the machine gun. The Chinese were mostly down, cries and grunts, no one returning fire. The rifles came now, ricochets off the rocks. He heard men coming down the hill, faint silhouettes in the dark. Marines. Saw a burst from a BAR spraying the Chinese bodies.
Sons of bitches, we get 'em all? Hope so. Come on, more down that way.
Riley pulled himself up, wanted to shout. Anything. Held his silence. Too dangerous. The men began to move along the hillside, away from him, and now there was a shower of tracers from across the draw, the Marines falling, a sharp cry. The fire went both ways now, a machine gun uphill from him, a duel over Riley's head. He lay flat on the frozen ground, waited an eternity, a minute or more, the guns finally quiet. Riley looked up the hill close by, thought of calling out, his brain holding it in. The thought, you're in the wrong damn place. Just get the hell out of here. Find Welch. He slid on his belly away from the dead Chinese, but there were more bodies in front of him, more smells, garlic and spent powder. He rose up, the moonlight reflecting off a sea of bodies, and he looked up the hill, realized he was far down. No landmarks he could see. There was more firing from the crest, ragged silhouette of rocks, nothing familiar, no sounds but the rattle of the rifle fire. The saddle was far off to the left, and he thought, move that way, up the hill, that's where we were. I hope to God that's where we still are. I got no use being out here on my own, dumb son of a bitch. He clawed his way through the hard rocks, frozen fingers, cold sweat inside his coat. He slid himself uphill now, very slow, quiet movement, staring at the ridgeline. They gotta be there, he thought. We dug in all over that peak. Somebody's gotta be home. He thought of calling out again. No, not yet. Get closer. They need to see you. He crept closer, sliding through the snow, sharp rocks under his belly, staring through the darkness. No movement. He's there, he thought. Somewhere. All right. Do this. Marine here! His voice seemed to explode out of him, and he lay low, waited, heard a nervous voice very close. Who the hell are you? I'll blow your damn brains out. Marine, I promise. 3rd platoon. There was silence for a moment, hushed whispers a few yards above him, and now a different voice. Yeah, asshole, who won the World Series? Riley felt a new panic, his brain screaming for answers. Baseball. Oh, Christ. Yankees! Beat the Phillies in 4! There was another silent moment, and the second man said, Okay, get your ass up here. He scrambled that way, up on his knees now, reached the foxhole, saw 2 figures, rifles and grenades. His breathing came in short gasps, frantic words. Thanks. Name's Riley. 3rd platoon. Don't care. You're not a chink. You're in 1st platoon area. What the hell are you doing out here? Hauling ammo for a 30? My Sarge? Guess I got lost. Where's the ammo? We could use some. Riley lowered his head. Out there somewhere. Great. Not only are you lost, but you're worthless, too. Guess so. At least I knew about the World Series. If you say so. We took your word for it. Neither one of us knows hog tits about baseball. Chapter 26 Riley Fox Hill, November 29th, 4 a.m. He stayed with the 2 men for more than an hour, but the Chinese had seemed to pull away, the only fire coming from the mortars, occasional blasts of illuminating shells, mostly out toward the saddle. The foxhole was a tight fit, and Riley kept his stare down the hillside, let the others get some sleep. The pains in his knees, the raw scrape on his face, added a new discomfort to the misery of the cold, and he dabbed at his cheek, clamped his jaw down tightly, testing if he had lost any teeth. Friendly fire, he thought. Had to be. Haven't heard any enemy artillery anywhere. Not yet, anyway. But hell, last night there weren't mortars, and now they brought 'em up. I guess. Unless that was friendly fire, too. His eyes strained to see, and he realized there was a light haze of snowfall. There were more details now, the dawn coming on slowly, and he glanced at his new partners, thought, I gotta get out of here. Welch will be going nuts, or he'll just be pissed. He thought of the ammo cans, back on the hill somewhere. Maybe somebody will find them, get some good out of them. Hopefully us. He felt stirring close beside him, one of the men waking, and he bent low, whispered, Hey, if you're awake, I gotta head back to my unit. The voice grumbled up from below. Yeah, go on. I guess it's time for breakfast. The snow was heavier now, and Riley crawled up, one knee on the hard dirt, pushing himself out of the hole. He looked out over the hill, eyed the crest, rocks spread all along, thick brush in patches. He began to move, and the man spoke behind him. Low voice. Hey, Mac, just so you know, I was gonna plug you. My buddy figured you were okay. Yeah? Well, thanks to your buddy. He started to crawl, the ground layered in thin, powdery snow. The breeze was coming again, and he could see more detail, realized there was a sharp crevice in the hillside, the brush thicker still. He pushed on, slipped above the thicket, heard a snap of branches, froze. There were dead men all around him, all of them Chinese, and he kept still, one hand moving to the 45. The movement in the brush continued, no other sound, and he drew the pistol, tried to flex his stiff fingers, feeling numbly for the safety, sliding his bare trigger finger into the guard. He rolled over, sat, the pistol pointing into the brush. More sounds, closer, his eyes finding more details in the soft, gray light. The man appeared now, crawling, the white uniform, his face down, pulling himself free of the brush. Riley blinked, fought the frost around his eyes, aimed the pistol, waited, the man a few feet in front of him, moving closer. The man stopped, seemed to rest, sinking low. No weapon that Riley could see. One voice rolled through him, a prisoner. Take him prisoner. He waited one more second, then said, "Hey!" The man popped his head up, wide-eyed surprise, the two men staring at each other for a long second. Riley jerked the pistol upward, a signal, kept the aim on the man's face. The Chinese soldier seemed to understand, moved to his knees, his hands coming up slowly to the top of his head. Riley didn't know what to do. Was sitting, his feet extended, awkward position, and the soldier kept his stare on the pistol. Riley struggling to pull his legs closer. "You just stay put there, pal." Riley tried to turn around, still aiming the pistol, felt stupidly awkward. The soldier watching him now, a glance backward. The brush behind the man erupted now. Another man, a surge of motion toward him, a burp gun firing. Riley shouted, fired the pistol, then again, the burp gun dropping. Now another man was there, down beside the prisoner, a rifle in his hands, firing from the hip, blinding flashes. Riley firing into the man's belly, dropping him. The brush was alive with movement, manic voices, but the men were moving away, down the hill, hidden by the deep cut in the hillside. Riley fired again, aiming at his prisoner, the man crawling away, falling flat. Riley fired again, emptying the pistol. No targets. Aiming at noise. And to one side, up on the ridge, a machine gun opened up, chattering fire into the deep draw, splattering the ground, chopping the brush. More men began to crush down the hill, hidden still by the brush, the machine gun finding them, sharp cries. He pushed at the ground with his feet, backed himself frantically up the hill, more fire from the machine gun slicing down in front of him. He wanted to shout, felt the heart-ripping terror, lay flat now, on his back. The machine gun fired again, a shorter burst, then stopped, silence now but for the thunder in his ears. He waited, rolled over slowly, still had the pistol in his hands, peered up beneath the hood of his coat. The machine gun was just off the crest, a formation of rocks, one tall stone.
"Hamp! It's me!" "Oh, shut up. I figured that out. Only you'd be that damn lost."
Riley rose up slowly, looked back toward his would-be prisoner, the man's chest peppered with holes, his blood oozing out, a thickening pool on the hard ground beside him. Riley pulled himself away, turned, saw several Marines coming down, rifles in hand, faces. One of them the kid, Morelli.
"Jesus, Pete, we thought they got you again. We've been watching this bunch, knew they were in this draw. You got him to come out."
He looked at the others. Kane, slinging his BAR up on his shoulder, and Kane stared past him, nodded, said,
"Good job, Pete. Remind me to take you fishing sometime. You make damn good bait."
Welch called out,
"Check 'em out. Make sure they're dead enough. See what they're carrying."
The men moved past Riley, Kane probing one of the bodies with the BAR. Firing a short burst. Riley jumped, surprised, and Kane moved to the next man, said,
"This one's done. Check him out, kid."
Riley watched with horrified curiosity. Morelli leaning low, his hand sliding into the man's coat. Kane looked at Riley, saw his expression, laughed.
"Yep, we give him all the good jobs."
Morelli stood now, held something in his hand.
"Soap and toothpaste. American stuff, just like the others. And he's wearing that vest.
Riley looked down, didn't know what Morelli meant.
What vest?
Kane said, We were wondering why the carbines weren't dropping these chink bastards, like the damn slugs was bouncing off. They're wearing some kind of hemp thing. Word went out last night to everybody who's still stuck with a carbine. Aim for the head. He held up the BAR. Another smile. Didn't have that problem myself.
Get your asses back up here.
Riley saw Welch now, standing at the machine gun, the young Lieutenant Goolsby standing beside him. Welch called out, louder now.
There's sniper fire down that way. Get it done, then get back into cover. This ain't a picnic.
Kane looked again at the handful of bodies, said to Morelli, Hey, kid, your turn. Plug each one of them, just to be sure. Morelli looked at him.
You sure it's okay?
Kane said, Captain's orders, kid.
Do it.
Riley stood now, eased the stiffness from his legs. Said to Kane, Did the captain really order that? Kane was serious now.
I ain't lying, Pete. Too many of our guys were getting nailed by wounded chinks.
He watched Morelli slip down the hill, probing more of the bodies, and now a single shot rang out, then another. Morelli stepping from body to body, the M1 pointed down into each man's head. Riley turned away, didn't want to watch that. Looked up toward Welch, the sergeant standing with his hands on his hips, observing. The others waited for Morelli to finish the job, the kid climbing up from the draw, looking at Riley with a smile. Riley moved up the hill, the others spreading out. Welch calling out again.
Get in your damn holes. The air boys ought to show up pretty soon, and nobody needs to be hunting souvenirs.
The men spread out, moving to their own places on the ridge, and Riley stepped closer to Welch, who said,
Where the hell's my ammo? How'd you end up way the hell out there?
Riley started to speak, felt exhausted relief, adding to the weariness of the long night. He felt the cold engulfing him again, said,
Sorry. Screwed up. Yeah, of course you did. I got ammo from one of the carriers. Made him stay with me and do your job. The chinks tried like hell to grab this 30. Figured out a little trick. Started pulling the tracers out of the belt so they couldn't find me. They didn't figure that one out yet. Pretty easy to locate a chink machine gun when he's shooting green at you.
He stared at Riley, fixed on his face.
You look like hell. Like that bar fight in Guam. Shell came down. Knocked me ass over tea kettle. Lost the ammo.
Welch put a hand on Goolsby's shoulder, seemed to be checking on him, and Riley was surprised to see blood on the lieutenant's face.
Same thing happened to him. Percussion grenade. Hey, Lieutenant, you hearing me okay?
Goolsby nodded, sat down now, and Welch bent low beside him.
We better get you to the aid station, sir.
Goolsby seemed to come awake, said,
No, Lieutenant McCarthy is down. I have to stay up here.
Welch stood, said to Riley,
I guess he's in charge for now. McCarthy's down the hill, legs busted up good.
Riley watched Goolsby, saw him shake his head again, trying to blow out the fog.
Sir, if we get you into a hole, warm you up a little, might help.
Goolsby looked up at Riley, nodded. Welch helped Goolsby to his feet again, Riley taking him by the other arm. They moved together, the foxholes close in front of them, and Welch said,
Easy. Here you go, sir. Just sit tight. I'll find a corpsman, have him check you out.
Goolsby settled low in the hole.
Thank you, Sergeant. Look after the men. I'll be okay. Just a knock on the head.
There was a scattering of rifle fire down to the side, and Riley looked that way, said,
Second platoon?
Welch reached down, picked up the Thompson, and beside it, Riley's M1.
Here. Might come in handy. There have been snipers all morning long. The chinks are lousy shots, mostly, but stay on your toes. No wandering around.
Riley took the rifle, Welch handing him a pair of clips. He slipped them into his pocket, looked down the hill, the thicket of brush, the bodies of the Chinese soldiers. Why'd you make the kid do that? Welch pulled his coat tighter, fighting a new gust of wind.
Didn't have to. Turns out, he likes it. He's having as much fun out here as that idiot Irishman.
Riley felt a jolt.
How's he doing? Killian, I mean. He'll live. Not so some of the others. We took a few more good hits last night. You change your socks lately? Nope. Come on, let's go down the hill. I'll tell the lieutenant we'll try to find him a corpsman. I'm betting they're mostly down at the tents now. A single round took out the captain and Lieutenant McCarthy last night. Last I saw them, they were both heading down to the tents. Some chink tossed a percussion grenade right into Goolsby's hole. Lucky to still have his head.
Riley remembered the doctor and barber now at the aid station.
I saw the captain. They were working on him. They're going to be working on all of us if we don't get off this hill. Grab whatever gear you need. Your knapsack, your spare socks. You probably pissed your long johns, too. You ought to get some rations. There's a big-ass box of Tootsie Rolls down at the aid station. It's pretty quiet for now. Chinks ain't interested in daylight assaults. The air boys keep popping up out of nowhere. Damn beautiful sight. Chinks will wait until dark to make trouble.
Welch was moving off, Riley struggling to keep up, the painful stiffness in his knees, watery cold in his boots. He thought of the tents down below, felt a growling hunger rising in his gut, thoughts of Tootsie Rolls. The screams caught his attention as they moved past the medical tent, the cries of the wounded blending with the orders called out by the doctor. Beyond was the warming tent, the parking place for the men who had already been treated. Riley stopped, focused on a row of corpses laid out between two fat trees. The faces were covered, the bodies draped with a thin coating of snow. At the tent, Welch said, "How long are you going to stand there? Nothing you can do for them." Maybe, he thought, if I hadn't been stumbling around in the dark. He knew better than to feel guilty about any of the casualties, that no matter what anyone had done, there was a bullet or a grenade or a mortar shell that could find you. The worst had been the direct hit into a foxhole, a mortar shell obliterating the men who had crouched low, believing they were safe. Haven't seen that yet, he thought. Not out here. He looked at Welch, who showed him unusual patience.
Sorry, Hemp. Head's a little foggy. Make way!
Riley turned, saw two teams of stretcher-bearers moving quickly downhill, headed for the medical tent. He moved aside, the first team carrying their man inside. The second team halted outside, waited for space, one man saying to Riley or to no one at all,
"Damn sniper! Second platoon's still catching hell from the west hill. Lieutenant Peterson's up there half full of lead, still running the show. Hell of a thing."
Riley looked at Welch, said, "Maybe we ought to go back up. Pretty busy place."
"You got a buddy in that warming tent. He's a jackass, but he's still a buddy. I want to check on the lieutenant, see what's up. And I'm damn cold."
He followed Welch into the tent, not quite warm, but a definite improvement from the cold outside. The sounds were scattered and many. A sharp scream at the far end of the tent, a hard groan rising up from a man to one side. He tried not to see the details, the smells overwhelming him. Welch said,
"Here's your buddy. Hey, Irish, you awake or just goofing off?"
Killian lay on the ground, one of a row of men, each stuffed in a sleeping bag. Riley moved closer, bent low, said,
"Hey, Sean, you okay?"
Killian looked up at him, staring through grogginess.
"I'm alive, I think."
Riley saw the bandage on his neck, said,
"How's the wound?"
Killian was still trying to focus, blinking his eyes, and Welch said,
"He's doped up. Morphine. Hey, Irish, how big's the hole in your head?
Killian shook his head slowly, one hand coming out of the sleeping bag, a clumsy poke at the bandage.
Not bad. Missed the important stuff. But the problem is my feet.
Riley could see fear in Killian's glassy eyes, and Killian reached clumsily for Riley's arm.
I'm done for, Pete. My feet are dead. Frostbite. Something like that. They say I can't fight no more.
Welch moved closer, down beside Riley.
You slack-jawed bastard. I want you back up on this hill by tonight.
Riley knew Welch wasn't serious, had heard this kind of test before, pushing Killian to see if he'd push back. But Killian didn't respond, the morphine carrying him off someplace else. Beside Killian, another man spoke.
Leave him be. It's the shoe packs. Bunch of us here got nothing left to stand on. I lost most of the hide off the soles of both feet. You thaw out, and you know what the hell pain feels like. They're supposed to evacuate us. Hospitals. All of that.
Killian seemed to doze off, and Riley stood. Looked at the other man, said,
You warm enough at least? For now. They keep bringing them in, though. And there ain't enough room.
Riley bent down, slipped Killian's arm back inside the bag, pulled the loose top up over Killian's face. The other man said,
Hey, can you do that for me? My arm's busted up. Can't move.
Sure. Riley pulled at the man's sleeping bag, caught the strong smell of urine now. He looked through the tent, a pair of corpsmen tending to patients, some of them on cots, another row of men in sleeping bags, stuffed against one end of the tent.
I'll get you somebody. Take care of that.
The man didn't respond, seemed to fade into sleep, and Riley was angry now, wanted to call out, order someone to look out for these men. Welch was beside him, seemed to read him.
They'll get to him when they can. We're just in the way. Come on, we got better things to do. I don't see McCarthy. Maybe in the other tent.
Riley looked at the other men, the few cots jammed together, couldn't ignore the cries, the misery muffled by morphine. He heard Killian's voice, then a soft groan, more words. His name. Riley knelt low again, pulled back the bag, said,
I'm right here. You need something?
Oh, God, Pete. It hurts. My feet. They're gonna chop off my feet.
A corpsman was there now, eased Riley out of the way.
No, they're not. We just gotta get you to the hospital ship, maybe Tokyo.
Killian calmed, the grogginess settling over him again. Riley felt a desperate helplessness, said to the corpsman,
You sure?
The man stood again, said,
You bet. Might lose some toes. There's some a lot worse.
The man moved away, tending to more of the men in the sleeping bags, and Riley caught the hard smell of excrement, felt himself getting sick, tried to stifle it. He backed away, stumbled against a cot, a man responding with a sharp yelp.
Oh, Jesus, sorry.
He searched for Welch, saw him moving out of the tent, and the man in the cot shouted now,
Get me out of here! I ain't dying!
The man reached for him, his hand clawing the air, and Riley backed off, the growling nausea worse. More smells, pushing him past the edge. He turned, hustled out of the tent, collapsed to his knees, vomited in the snow. The tears came now, the despair complete, the horrors overwhelming, the shame of his weakness. He felt a hand on his shoulder, the voice of Welch.
Get over it. You've smelled worse, seen worse, too.
Riley closed his eyes, still on his knees, hands down in the snow.
Don't know what happened.
No sleep? No food, assholes shooting at you all night long, and your buddy's crapped himself.
None of us are enjoying this, Pete. Get up. Riley rose, struggled to his feet, Welch with a hard grip under his arm. Another pair of stretcher-bearers came down the hill, the wounded man bloodied across his face. They moved inside quickly, and Riley said, "Where the hell are they putting all these guys? Outside? What about tonight, Hamp?"
"That ain't your problem. They're doing all they can. The best thing we can do is kill every damn chink out there so we can get back to some kind of camp."
"What are you doing here, boys?"
Riley knew the voice now, saw Captain Barber hobbling toward him, a crude wooden splint on his upper leg, a pair of makeshift tree branches for crutches. Two men were with him, and one said,
"I'll get the doctor, sir. You really should stay put here."
Barber waved one of the crutches at the man, just missing the man's leg.
"I'm fine. Too much to do. Get the damn doctor out here. Tell him to stick a fresh bandage on it. Go!"
He looked at Riley again.
"I said, what are you doing here?"
Welch said,
"Came down to see a buddy, Captain. We're heading back up. Your third platoon, right?"
"Yes, sir."
Barber seemed unsteady on the odd crutches, and Riley could tell that the man was in obvious pain. Barber said,
"I was with Lieutenant McCarthy. We both got hit. His leg's a mess. He's over at the other tent, last I saw."
Welch eyed the heavy bandage on the captain's upper thigh.
"Yes, sir, I know. I'm Sergeant Welch. Lieutenant Goolsby's in command of the rifle squads now. We'll be moving back up there right now."
Barber let out a breath, seemed to sag, then forced himself upright. Barber's aide returned now, the doctor in tow, the same man Riley had seen the night before. The doctor knelt close to Barber's leg, said,
"Damn it all, Captain. I wish you'd be a little smarter. This is a hell of a wound, and you don't need to lose this leg just because you're stubborn as hell. You damage the artery, and you'll lose more than the leg."
Barber scowled at the doctor, said,
"Just put a fresh bandage on it. Save the advice."
"All right, come inside."
"Do it right here. I got no time for your bedside manner."
Riley saw frustration on the doctor's face, saw the man produce the fresh dressing from his coat as though he had already expected to apply it on the spot. Barber raised his foot slightly, the doctor pulling at the splint, the old bandage stripped away, tossed aside. He worked quickly, the fresh dressing applied, wrapped with tape, and the doctor looked up at Barber, said,
"If it wasn't cold as hell, you'd have bled to death. You still might."
"It's not warming up any time soon, Doc. I've got work to do."
Barber looked at Welch again.
"Make it quick down here, Sergeant. There's a lot more going on than the problems we've got on this hill. I want all my platoon and fire team leaders at my CP in 10 minutes. I guess that means Goolsby. Give him the word."
Barber hobbled away, his two aides flanking him, prepared for a stumble. The doctor watched him go, said,
"Not sure what he's trying to prove. He feels guilty getting hit, like he's letting all of us down."
The doctor looked at Riley now, no recognition.
"You boys looking for someone in particular?"
Welch said,
"We found him, sir. Frostbite case."
"There are a lot of those, Sergeant. Not much we can do for him out here. I told the captain we need choppers to come in, but the enemy's shooting them up when they try to land."
"I got work to do, boys."
The doctor moved back into the tent, and Riley tested his gut, the nausea passing.
Never expected to see this kind of stuff. Feet freezing. Christ!
Welch said, "Never expected to see a Chinese soldier trying to stuff a grenade down my throat, but here we are. Do I have to tell you to change your damn socks?"
"Not anymore."
"Didn't think so. Do it right now. I'll wait. I want to check on McCarthy, and we still got to hunt down some rations."
Riley sat, went to work on the boots, pulled the dry socks from his belt. He could see down through the trees to the main road, the narrow strip of snow and dirt, what someone thought was so valuable. From across the road he heard a faint chatter from a distant machine gun, scattered rifle fire closer, above him, along the west side of the hill. Welch began to move out through the trees, and Riley followed. Heard more of the machine gun fire ripping across the hill behind him. Heard the pop of the rifles. Saw more stretcher bearers moving down. Another wounded man. One more sleeping bag. Less room for all the rest. The briefing from Barber to his officers and squad leaders was short and to the point. He had finally made radio contact with Colonel Litzenberg at Udomni. Barber relayed the description of just what had happened there and what still might happen, that both regiments had already endured a crushing assault from the Chinese from nearly every direction. But Litzenberg's message to Barber had been clear. If Fox Company could not move off their hill and add anything to that fight, it was essential that they stay exactly where they were. If the 5th and 7th Marines were to have any chance of escaping annihilation, the narrow road that led back through Toktong Pass had to remain in the hands of Barber's Marines. But there was more to Litzenberg's message. Litzenberg had finally learned of the situation beyond the Taibek Mountains, where much of the 8th Army was in a headlong retreat southward. And, for the first time, Barber and his men were told of the situation at Hagaru Ri. There, Chinese prisoners had offered the matter-of-fact detail that some 30,000 Chinese troops, the better part of 3 full divisions, was pushing in toward the Hagaru Ri perimeter from 3 directions. If Hagaru Ri fell to the enemy, the Marines at Udomni, as well as Barber's lone company, would be completely cut off. And there was no one anywhere in Korea who could offer any rescue. Chapter 27. Smith. Hagaru Ri, November 29th, noon. He sat in the jeep, huddled against the cold, the driver beside him as miserable as he was. Smith kept his gaze on the heavy equipment, the engineers laboring with as much effectiveness now as any time since the bulldozers arrived at Hagaru Ri. He wiped at his eyes, a hard frost already glued to his face.
Let's go.
The jeep rolled into motion, a tight turn onto the road back to the command tent. It's not done yet, he thought. But there's enough runway there to support smaller transports, probably the C-47s. Right now I'd settle for the Red Baron in his triplane. The wounded were overflowing the aid stations, hundreds now, many of them taking turns inside the warming areas, soaking up precious heat from the fat-bellied stoves. There was no room for all of them, not now, the casualty list passing 400. More men adding to the count every hour. There was no surprise to that, the Chinese striking hard at the perimeter, especially toward the east, the area around East Hill. But through it all, the engineers had continued their work, carving a magnificent airstrip out of frozen ground. Smith kept his head down, the only protection from the brutal cold, the jeep turning again, coming to a halt by the large tent. He glanced at the driver, goggles and earmuffs, offered a short nod.
Thank you, sir.